So with the Parsha B'Shalach, the chase is on in no uncertain terms. And there's a very interesting discussion, more than one in fact, not surprisingly, that relates to the opening pasuk of the Parsha. Vayihi B'Shalach Paro Sa'am, when Paro sent the people out. V'lo Nacham Elokim, regarding the route that Hashem took them. He didn't guide them or lead them Derech Eretz Pelishtim, by way of the land of the Plishtim, ki karov hu, because it was near, some say, although it was near, it's both. In other words, although it was near, so it would be the intuitive route, but because it was near, it was the less advised route. Ki amar elokim, for Hashem said, pen yinachem ha'am, v'rosam milchama v'shavu mitzrayma. Perhaps the people will regret, have second thoughts, when they see war, and they'll go back to Mitzrayim, as it is, as Rashi says, as it is, even taking them on the circuitous route, every now and then someone said, let's go back to Mitzrayim. Kal v'chomer, if they just took the highway, they take the opposite route back. And the Ibn Ezra, interestingly, amongst all the other concerns of Yetzias Mitzrayim, is bothered by the term pen. Pen yinachem ha'am. Perhaps they'll be afraid. Or more correctly in English, pen is lest they be afraid, which is a better translation. Because perhaps can mean either way. It can refer to something that you hope will happen. Perhaps my check will come. Or perhaps something terrible will happen. The word perhaps itself is equi-weighted. But as the Vilna Gaon points out, the word pen is always relates to something that might happen, but one hopes doesn't happen. And that's where the word lest is more correct. It's to forestall a negative occurrence. It's the famous Vilna Gaon in Parshas Chayei Sara, when Eliezer says to Avram, Ulai lo toveha ishala leches acharai, perhaps she won't want to come. Should I take Yitzhak there? And Avram says, no. But Chazal famously comment on the fact that Eliezer, part of him was hoping that it wouldn't work out, so that Yitzhak could marry his daughter. Where do we see it in the word? So Rashi, as we know, actually learns it from the missing Vav. The second time round, it's written Aleph Lamed Yud, not Ulai, but Eli. And that's why the Pasuk says it there, and Rashi quotes there. But the Vilna Gaon is quoted as saying that it actually comes from the word Ulai itself. Because the difference, as we said, between Ulai and Pen is when you hope something won't happen. But Ulai is when you hope something will happen. So when Eliezer is discussing the prospect that she may not wish to come back with him, if he really didn't want it to happen, he would have said, or should have said, pen lo tovah ha'ishal lechazakarai. Ulai betrays the idea that perhaps Eliezer wanted it not to work on some level, as Chazal say, because of his daughter. So this is the connotation of the word pen. The problem is, when people talk about things that may or may not happen, they can use the word pen, because at the end of the day, it denotes an element of uncertainty. You don't know, and people don't know. I hope this won't happen, but maybe it will, lest it happen, etc. The problem is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows whether the Jewish people will be afraid. Either they will or they won't. Although it's a Bechira issue, but having said that, it is an instinctive thing. They'll either be afraid or not. So how can the Pasuk ascribe to HaKadosh Baruch Hu a term which denotes lack of definitely, lack of certainty? Pen, Hashem is saying, perhaps they won't. Is it perhaps? And Ibn Ezra responds with the adage from Chazal themselves of Dibra Torah Kalosha B'nei Adam. The Torah speaks the way people speak. But it's a very interesting way to adduce that concept here. Because when the Torah is talking to us, we could say it speaks the way people speak, it expresses itself the way people speak. But to speak about Hashem in the way that a person would speak, that's actually quite, that's another step. That Hashem said, perhaps, even though he knows, but if people would make a decision like that, they wouldn't know, and they would use the word pen. So that word is used also for HaKadosh Baruch Hu's concerns. But at the end of the day, he knew that it would happen, and that's why he led them on a different route. Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar, however, as amplified by the Haksava Kabbalah, this approach, Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar says that the word pen doesn't have to denote uncertainty. The word pen, first and foremost, relates to something that you do not wish to happen. But it could be equally valid even if you know that it will happen, but you don't want it to happen. And that's how he explains the pasuk here. The Ksava Kabbalah just elaborates a little bit that actually the word pen, and of course the forte of the Ksava Kabbalah is to see how words are connected to each other, how they work in groups or families. But the word pen comes from the word lefanos, which is to remove, to get rid of something. And therefore the word pen refers to forestalling something. Sometimes you don't know that whether it will happen, and sometimes you do, and you don't want it to happen. So therefore that's pen, your mefaneh. You remove it as an option. And that's, as we said, an elaboration of Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar. So as we see here, even as on a basic Lashon HaKodesh level, a major discussion on this point between the Ibn Ezra and Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar. Does the word pen always denote uncertainty, and that is ascribed to Hashem because Dibra Torah Kaloshim B'nei Adam? But does it not necessarily denote uncertainty at all? It's used very accurately. Hashem says, I don't want that to happen. Pen, and therefore I'm leading them in this circuitous route. But what will cause them to move on a little bit in the pasuk? What would cause them to regret or try and retrace their steps? Bir osam milchama, when they see war, which is itself quite a benign way of referring to encountering war. Seeing war means they're in the war. Which war? Rashi comments. Rashi says, bir osam milchama, and he refers to examples of the Amaleki and the Kanani. Those are the wars that will cause them to reconsider, perhaps to go back. And what's noteworthy about this comment of Rashi is that the wars that the Pasuk is referring to are not wars that they are avoiding now by going this circuitous route. It's not the point that if I take them directly, there'll be war, and therefore I'll take them indirectly and there won't be war. No, the wars will happen regardless. The point is, if there's a direct route back, when the wars come, they'll take the first route, they'll take the first opportunity to retrace their steps. But if it's circuitous, so then when the time for the wars come, they will not go back. It's very interesting, just on a very in a practical level. If there is a direct route, Derech Eretz Plishtim, that even if you took them on a circuitous route, by the time they get to Eretz Yisrael, what's to stop them from taking the direct route back? As much as they took a roundabout route to get here, but they're here and there is a direct route back. What difference does it make if they came out on the direct route that would lead them to perhaps go back the direct route? Let them go out on a circuitous route. They'll still go back the direct route, if there is such. Unless we say, although it's a little bit balabatish, that if they didn't travel the direct route, maybe they won't be as inclined to retrace their steps. Those are steps they never took in the first place.
How would they know? If they didn't go in that route, would they know that there isn't such a route?
I'm not sure. It could be that if they have a sense that they're going all over the place, right? So I don't know how hard it is for them to work out. But it may be that simple. Take them roundabout, and therefore the direct route will be unknown to them. Certainly signposting wasn't what it used to be, and in fact it's still that bad in some of these areas anyway. However, there are Rishonim who explain that the wars that would cause them to reconsider, for which reason Hashem didn't take them by way of the Plishtim, are wars with the Plishtim. In other words, it's not just that they'd have a more direct route to go back. These are the wars that they'd encounter, which would be too soon or they'd be otherwise unnecessarily prepared. That's what the Ramban says. War with the Plishtim would cause them to turn back Derech Eretz Plishtim. The question is, why would there be a war with the Plishtim? What's that? Where did those wars come from? And here, there are two fascinating suggestions from later Rishonim. The Baalei HaTosfos, although they're actually contemporaries with Ramban, the Baalei HaTosfos say, very interestingly, that Plishtim and Mitzrayim are close to each other. They're Mishpacha, if you go back to Parshas Noah, where they all come from the same cluster. And therefore, it could be that the Plishtim, if the Jewish people leave by way of Plishtim, the Plishtim would come to the support of the Mitzrim, their kinsmen, to return them back. They'd collaborate with them. That could be a war. And so much so, says the Tosfos, that this may give us a different translation of the words Kikarovhu. Hashem didn't lead them by way of the Plishtim. Kikarovhu. What does that mean? We translate Kikarovhu as referring to the derech. The way is near. But the Tosfos say that Kikarovhu means the Plishtim is a Karov. A Karov of who? A relative of Mitzrayim. So if you escape from one person, but you go by way of his Karov, he may then go to war to try and get them to go back, and maybe they actually will do so. So that's quite a chiddush from the Tosfos. Without getting too much into the details, it happens to be, as a rule, that, the Gemara discusses this famously at the beginning of Kiddushin, Derech is often a feminine noun. So perhaps Derech would have been Kikrovahi, if it's the Derech Eretz Plishtim. So if it refers more to the Plishtim themselves, so maybe they are the Krovim, although it's Balashon Yachid. The Chizkuni, one of the later Rishonim, has a different understanding. And again, all of this just makes us mindful of so many of the events of Yetzias Mitzrayim, and in this case, even before Yetzias Mitzrayim, just to fill out the picture. It happens to be that there was already an altercation of sorts with the Plishtim. How so? There were the famous B'nai Ephraim, and they are referred to in the Pasuk, alluded to in the Pasuk, and then Hema Naflu B'yom Karav, Noshke Rome Keshes, the Pasuk says in Tehillim. Who was the B'nai Ephraim? They were the ones who miscalculated. They actually left 30 years, or tried to leave 30 years, before everyone else. It's complicated to make the cheshbon of the 400 years, even with all the answers, you still have to work it out. And in the end, from the Brisbane Abisarim, it ended up being 430 years. They took the first available calculation of 400 years from the Brisbane Abisarim, which was actually 30 years before Yetzias Mitzrayim. And they left, but it was before the time, but they left anyway, and they were decimated by the Plishtim in Gat. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky famously says in his commentary on the Chumash Bereishis that of all the tribes to leave early, it was specifically Ephraim, because they were the most traumatized, shall we say, by their ill treatment of the Egyptians, because they were born in Egypt. Ephraim was born and bred in Egypt. He was the younger brother, even relatively more acclimatized. And therefore, for everyone else coming from Canaan, they didn't have such high expectations of the Mitzrayim. But for someone who grew up in Mitzrayim, and he's even the younger one, and to have his former neighbors turn on him, and no need to elaborate on that point, that was too much for him to bear. First available calculation, they were out. But it was too early, and they were killed by the Plishtim. And therefore, says the Chizkuni, the reason why there could be a war if the Jewish people go Derech Eretz Plishtim, because the Plishtim might feel that the Jewish people have come to avenge their brothers that the Plishtim killed 30 years earlier, and that would provoke a war. It's enough that they infer on the Jewish people's behalf an intent of war, to lead itself to a war, and that is the Chizkuni's understanding of what the war would be with the Plishtim, for which reason Hashem said, the time for war will come, but it's not going to be with the Plishtim. We'll lead them round about, and the war with Canaan, it will be a circuitous route, and that will be much, much later on. So these are some very interesting discussions that relate to the opening pasuk of Shalach. Of course, the center of the parsha, although there are many things in the parsha, is Kriyas Yamsuf, and we could quote the classics, we cut to the chase, or chase to the cut, as the case may be, and get to Kriyas Yamsuf. And I'd like to explore a number of elements that relate to Kriyas Yamsuf, perhaps beyond what we normally see within the splitting of the Yamsuf. By which I mean, I think it would be fair to describe Kriyas Yamsuf as saying that it was really the final chapter or the final segment, both of the punishment of the Egyptians and of the salvation of the Jewish people. At that point, that's Vigalti, according to Rabbeinu Bachya. If we go back to our famous four stages, Vitzesi, Itzalti, Vigalti, so Vilokachti number four is Matan Torah. But Vigalti number three is Kriyas Yamsuf. That's why we say Shira Chadosha Shibchu Geulim. They're called Geulim after Kriyas Yamsuf because that was the stage of Geula. So we look upon, on a straightforward level, the events of Kriyas Yamsuf as the final stage of redemption of the Jewish people and retribution from the Egyptians. But we see from the Medrash that Kriyas Yamsuf is more than that. It's more than an event that happened to us. Rather, it is an event that formed us, that defines us. Why do I say this? Because there's a surprising comment of the Medrash, it's in Bereishis Rabbah, on the word Ivri. Bereishis is where Avram is called an Ivri. He's only called Ivri once, and that's in Parshas Lech Lecha, Vayavo HaPalit, Vayaged LaAvram HaIvri, that's where he's called an Ivri, and that's where Chazal and after them the Mefarshim talk about the connotation of the word Ivri. And the Jewish people are called Ivrim a lot in these parshas, in the Yetzias Mitzrayim parshas. What is the meaning of the word Ivri? Well, some interpretations we know. Avram, why is he an Ivri? Descended from Aver, perhaps. Or perhaps he's on one side of the divide and everyone else is on the other side. He's me Aver Echad, everyone's me Aver Asheni, and various other such interpretations. But one of them, says the Medrash, is that the word Ivrim is a contracted form of the two words Ovar Yam. Ivrim, Ayin Beis Reish, Yud Mem, Ivrim is Ovar Yam. That means, referring to the Yamsuf, that means that the Jewish people, and even though crossing the Yamsuf happened much later, but clearly the timing is of a lesser concern, but what we do see is that passing through the Yamsuf gives the Jewish people significantly their name. They're called Ivrim because they passed through the Yam. But that itself must alert us to the fact that passing through the Yam isn't just something that happened to them, because things that happen to you don't define you. Things that define you, things that form you, things that make you happen, they define you. So how does passing through the sea of our Yam become the name Ivrim? How does Kriyas Yamsuf define us? In what way? It's possible to identify, if we may call them for our purposes, tributaries to the splitting of the Yamsuf. By which I mean certain earlier acts that were instrumental in bringing about the splitting of the Yamsuf. What such acts? There is a famous medrash relating to a pasuk that we say in Halel, Hayam Ra'a Vayonos. That's how we describe Kriyas Yamsuf in Halel. The sea saw, and it fled. Vayonos, says the Medrash, and the Medrash often asks questions like this. The pasuk says the sea saw. What did it see? The pasuk doesn't say what it saw. So the Medrash says, Ma ra'a, arono shel Yosef ra'a. It saw Yosef's coffin that had been brought out in Mitzrayim. What's that got to do with Hayam ra'a vayonos? Because the word vayonos is used with reference to Yosef. With Potiphar's wife, she grabbed his cloak, Vayonos vayetzeyachutza. He fled and he went outside. And the Medrash makes an association between Hayam Ra'a Vayonos and Yosef's Vayonos vayetzeyachutza. And what that means is when the sea sees Yosef, it splits. Interestingly, there is a remez to this in the Parsha itself with a very basic question. The taking of Yosef's bones is mentioned, as we know, in the beginning of Parshas Bishalach, by Yikach Moshe's Atzmos Yosef Imo. And many Mefarshim wonder, why is that pasuk placed here in the beginning of Bishalach? Surely, he can't have them in the beginning of Bishalach unless he took them in the middle of Parshas Bo, which is when we actually left. And if that's true, then when the pasuk describes the leaving of Mitzrayim, that's where it should have said, they left and Moshe took Atzmos Yosef. It doesn't mention it there. It mentions it here in the beginning of Bishalach, leading up to Kriyas Yamsuf. And some see that as actually corroboration of what the Medrash is saying, that the taking of Yosef's bones was actually a trigger or a catalyst of sorts for Kriyas Yamsuf. The question, of course, is how? As if to say, it was a great deed that Yosef did. It was great. It was very heroic, and more than that, it was extremely elevated act. But seemingly one of many, of many great people. What is the specific connection between Yosef's Vayonos Achutza, his experiences with Potiphar's wife, and the splitting of the Red Sea? There is a concept that we find a number of places, depending on how you read the Psukim, a number of places throughout the Chumash, and that is emulating Hashem, going in Hashem's ways, the way that it's described. Rashi quotes it, it's Midrashim, just like he's compassionate, you be compassionate, Mahu Chanun, Apa'ata Techanun, Achrei Hashem Lekechem Teilechu, to go after Hashem, Ludov Kabo, to cleave to his ways. These are all sources for the idea, which, when you think about it, is really a very major idea of what it means to succeed spiritually, is to emulate Hashem, not just quote unquote to do good deeds, but to emulate the ultimate goodness of Hashem. The very first reference to this idea of emulating Hashem is found in Az Yashir, in a very interesting drasha, which is in sourced in Maseches Shabbos, Daf Kuf Lamed Gimel, on the word Zekeli Va'anvehu. This is my God, and I will glorify him. I think we're familiar maybe with other drushes that come out from those words. Zekeli Va'anvehu. Hidur Mitzvah. Hisna'i Lefanav B'mitzvahs. But Abba Shol, in Maseches Shabbos there, says, Zekeli Va'anvehu means to emulate Hashem. Hevei Doma Lo. Be similar to Hashem. Be kind, compassionate, graceful, generous. How does emulating Hashem derive from the word va'anvehu? Rashi says an amazing thing. That Rashi explains that according to Abba Shaul, the word va'anvehu is a contraction of two words. Ani v'hu. Va'anvehu. Ani v'hu. Me and him. Meaning, I'm like him. I'm with him. That's how Rashi explains. What this leaves us to try and fathom is, why is this concept, and of course it's a major concept, but we've got the rest of Torah to deal with major concepts. How does it find its way into Shiras Hayam? Of all the things to say in Az Yashir, there are many things that are very apropos, how does this idea of emulating Hashem find its way into those key words, Zekeli Va'anvehu? Why was that a significant or relevant concern at the time of Kriyas Yamsuf? There is a very interesting discussion that revolves around Pasuk Ches of the Shira. Again, for words that we say so often, certainly well worthwhile to look at them closely. Uveruach apecha ne'emu mayim. And through the translating, literally through the breath of your nostrils, Ne'ermu mayim. What is the meaning of the words ne'ermu mayim? The simplest translation of ne'ermu mayim is that the waters piled up, related to the word arema. Arema is a pile, like in Shir HaShirim, Itnech Aremas Chitim. So arema is a pile, and therefore the passive verb of that, ne'ermu mayim, is that the water is piled up, which they did, on either side. What's interesting is, and that's how Rashi explains on a simple level, but Unculus translates differently. Unculus translates the words ne'ermu mayim as chakimu maya. The water became wise. Chakimu maya. How does ne'ermu mean wisdom? Because the word ne'ermu for Unculus is related not to arema, a pile, but orma. And orma is a form of wisdom or cunning. Orum. So for Unculus, ne'ermu mayim means the water became wise. But that itself is somewhat mystifying. What does it mean for water to become wise? And why is the splitting of the Red Sea attributed to wisdom in the water? I mean, these are elements that we're not entirely sure how to handle. But the Vilna Gaon elaborates on this comment of Unculus. And the Gaon says, if you wish to understand how the water became wise, where did it get its wisdom from, if we can even ask such a question? Says the Vilna Gaon, if you want to know where the wisdom of the water came from, chakimu maya, just go back to the beginning of the pasuk to see where the wind came from. It's so easy to read this pasuk many times, but not really to confront what the pasuk is saying. Beruach apecha means the wind that split the yamsuf came from Hashem. Ruach apecha, the breath of your nostrils. If you breathe out through your nostrils, it means that wind comes from within you. Which means the wind that split the Red Sea, it wasn't a wind as we normally describe winds, however the pressures and the currents work and all of that. It was breathed into it by Hashem, Ruach HaPecha. And as soon as we notice this, we cannot help but be mindful of the other time in the Torah where Hashem breathed into something, and look what happened. What did Hashem breathe into first? To man. He took Ofra min ha'adama, as Parshas Bereishis described, vayipach ba'apam, and breathed into him, nishmas chayim. When Hashem breathes, what comes out? A soul. And the soul goes into man, and man became an elevated being. Vayihi ha'adam l'nefesh chaya. Says the Vilna Gaon. So if you wonder, if you're wondering where the wisdom of the water came from, just remember what was blown into it. Breath, so to speak, from Hashem. So if Hashem blows from himself into the water, it's going to attain an element of wisdom. And that's how it's split. Still, it's fair to say we're a little bit mystified, as if to say, what does that mean? The water became wise and realized it should split. Presumably, the water would have split. Even water that's not smart does what it's told if Hashem manipulates it. But somehow something else was going on here. If we wish to appreciate a deeper dimension within Kriyas Yamsuf, within the solidifying of the water that allowed us to go through, we need to talk for a moment about water itself. What are the associations of water? What are its connotations? And here the Maharal, and we shouldn't be surprised that water can have many connotations, maybe even conflicting connotations. Even in our experience, water can have conflicting results. It can give life, it can take life. The Maharal begins by directing us back to the name Moshe. Moshe is called, as the Pasuk says, in Shmos Perek Beis. Why is he called Moshe? Ki min ha-mayim ishisihu. He was drawn up from the water. And the Maharal asks a question that some people might think, but not ask. But the Maharal asks. And that is, how does this come to be Moshe's name? Drawn up from the water, and this is the name that he's known by. Chazal tell us he actually had more than one name. He had 10 or 14 names. But this is the primary name, no question about it. He's called Moshe. But isn't it true that a name is meant to tell you something about the person? We say that a name encapsulates the essence of a person. Rabbi Meir is famous for doing that. Dorish b'shma. He would darshan people's names. If a person's called a name, it means something. And if that's true generally, so then kal vachomer, it will be true for someone like Moshe Rabbeinu. But this doesn't seem to encapsulate Moshe Rabbeinu at all. There's no doubting it is a significant event. And if this event hadn't happened, then nothing else would have happened. That's true. But that doesn't encapsulate Moshe. If we would list five great qualities of Moshe, I don't think this would be on the list. Not at the bottom and not at all. Led the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim, through the Yam Suf, transmitted the Torah, in his merit the man fell, taught them Torah, etc. There's no shortage of things that of great attainments of Moshe. And this seems to miss them all. So how is it his name? That's the Maharal's question in the Sefer Gevuras Hashem. Gevuras Hashem is Maharal's Sefer, which is dedicated to matters of Yetzias Mitzrayim and Geula. And the Maharal says, no. The name Moshe does not miss everything. It says everything. With min ha-mayim ishisihu, you have encapsulated the totality of Moshe. All of his attainments and achievements are elaborations of that concept. How so? Says Maharal, to appreciate what it means to be drawn up from the water, we need to talk about water itself. And the key characteristic that the Maharal focuses on is that water represents something that has no form. It is pure matter, but has no form. Whatever you put it in, it assumes the form of that thing, because it has no form of itself. And if you spill it out on the ground, it has no form at all. And not only does water itself lack any form, it can even remove the form of things that it comes into contact with. It can erode, it can wipe away, it can erase, as we know. And to that end, water epitomizes and characterizes formlessness. And in fact, it's for this reason Maharal explains the punishment that met the famous Dor HaMabul in Parshas Noah, or the generation of Noah's time. They met their end through water. And it's interesting to ponder. I mean, there's no shortage of ways that they could have been punished. Some may even have taken less time, or whatever the other considerations are. Punishments are mida keneged mida, certainly something like this. Where is the measure for measure in that generation meeting their end through water? But the truth is, says Maharal, that if you're looking for a way to sum up all of the disaster that had become humankind at that time, all of the degeneration that had happened with the generations, it's that they'd lost their form. It's that human beings had lost a sense of dignity, of elevation, of Tzelem Elokim, of Tzura. They're acting like animals. All of the ways that they're described, all of the particular sins, all point to this. They're grabbing from each other, and there's no boundaries, not physically, and not respecting anyone's property, or even respecting themselves. One almost gets the feeling that the difference at that time between human beings and animals was just a question of two legs or four. In any other respect, you couldn't really tell. And because they had effectively, one could sum up the whole malaise of that time as having abdicated on their tzura, they descended into formlessness. That is why they were punished through water, which is itself formlessness. That's the mida keneged mida. So much so that it's noteworthy that the word mabul itself addresses this point. We translate the word mabul as flood, which is a good translation. But how does the word mabul mean flood? Rashi gives three interpretations of the word mabul. And one of them is that the word mabul relates to the concept mivale. And mivale means to wear away, balui, levalot. And why is the mabul called wearing away? Because that's what the flood did to the world. It wore it down. It pummeled it so much, it destroyed the form of everything. So it's very noteworthy that the very name of the flood comes from this quality of water, that it wears things down. It itself has no form, and it removes the form from other things. And that's the midah keneged midah for that generation. So with this in mind, says Maharal, go back to Moshe. And we look in with different eyes at the pasuk, which says, how would you sum up Moshe? It's with three words, min hamayim mishisihu, drawn up from the water. As if to say, if water represents absolute lack of form, then what Moshe is someone who is drawn up from that, away from that, away from formlessness to attain the ultimate form. That is to say, the ultimate distinction and development of his Tzelem Elokim. And as a result of that, he was able to achieve all the things that he did. But if you want to put it in one sentence, raised up from the water, away from that formlessness to attain form. So says Maharal. And with this in mind, we can now look quite differently at the significance and the fuller implications of Kriyas Yamsuf. Because Kriyas Yamsuf had the Jewish people moving through water, which was no longer formless. Because when the Jewish people moved through it, it attained form. It solidified. It piled up. It was walls on either side. The formless attained form. And what's the message? The message is, and it's very interesting because this really, it casts the experience of Yetzias, of Kriyas Yamsuf, not as just, quote unquote, a final stage of deliverance, but actually a stage of educating the Jewish people, of imparting a message to them. But what is the message? They're going from Mitzrayim, soon they'll be at Har Sinai to receive the Torah. But what is the Torah, if not a program for the Jewish people to assert form on a formless world, on themselves and on the world, to attain distinction, to attain elevation? That really is, that's what Torah is. It's got 613 subdivisions, but that's the goal. And the mission statement, therefore, of what it means to be Jewish is imparted to the Jewish people as they go through the Yam Suf. As if to say, what Hashem says to the Jewish people is, see what I'm doing. That's what you need to do. What have I done before you? I've taken the formless and asserted form on it. That's what you need to do. Remember this encounter, because that defines your unique mission. And now we understand what the Vilna Gaon is saying, that uveruach apecha ne'er mumayim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave a certain quality to the water, an elevated quality. Chakimu maya, they became wise. And as anything that becomes wise, if you use that wisdom, it gives you form where otherwise there is just substance and matter. And therefore, through the arma, through the wisdom that was attained by the water, they became arema. They became, they attained that form and solidified. And how do the Jewish people merit this? How do the Jewish people merit to go through the formless and it attains form before them? Well, they themselves, to their credit, have already begun to act in a more elevated way. Lech techa acharai b'midbar, pe'eretz lo zeruah. They've already extended themselves beyond the comfort that is water. They've taken the Korban Pesach 4 days before Pesach in full view of the Egyptians, laying themselves open to risk of damage, etc. But they're following an elevated instruction. And when they leave Mitzrayim, they don't know where they're going. But Hashem says, go, and they go. The Jewish people are already beginning to be form-friendly, tzura-friendly. But if there's one act that one can particularly point to as really an overwhelming trigger act that stands the Jewish people in good stead, go back to Yosef with Potiphar's wife. Because that really represents the ultimate assertion over a protracted amount of time of asserting tzura over chomer, of asserting form and distinction and elevated discipline and so on and so forth over what would otherwise just be physical matter and going with the flow, as they say. And this, therefore, is the deeper understanding of why it was the sight of Yosef's coffin that causes the sea to split. Hayam ra'a vayonos. And why? Because vayonos v'yetzeh chutzah. In other words, in the face of a people represented by someone like Yosef, who was in such an incredible way able to assert tzura over his activities and not allow them just to descend into the formlessness of chomer, so because of his fleeing, the sea flees and it splits before the Jewish people. But then they're followed by the Egyptians. And when the Jewish people go through and the Egyptians come in, the water collapses, the sea collapses. So of course, on a simple level, the point is that, well, the miracle's over. In other words, the Jewish people are saved and then need to be punished. So there's no need for the miracle to continue. Let things just return. But there's more to it than that. The reason why the water comes in when the Egyptians enter is because the Egyptians are a group of water. In other words, they represent the formlessness of the sea. The Pasuk will tell us in Parshas Vayikra, when it wants to warn the Jewish people off just living with complete hefkerus and in such a free and easy way with no boundaries or discipline, the way that it says it is, "Kema'asei Eretz Mitzrayim asher yeshavtem bo, lo ta'asu." Do not act in the way that you saw people act in Egypt. That's a terrible distinction to have in the Chumash. That you are the example of the people not to be in terms of physical relationships. But that's how the Egyptians are. Which means on a deeper level, one could say that each group, each of these two groups, the Jewish people and the Egyptians, they were, in a sense, they found themselves in the water. They were reflected by the water. The Jewish people, who are a people who are striving towards form and surah, so the water attains form for them. But the Egyptians, who have no notion of form, for them it's just matter, so therefore, when they're in the sea, it loses its form and collapses in over them. And indeed, as is well known, according to the Ibn Ezra, these two things happen simultaneously. The Ibn Ezra says we should not think that the timeline is stage one is the Jewish people went through and then they're out. And then stage two is the Egyptians come in and then the sea collapses. Not so. According to the Ibn Ezra, at the very same time that the Jewish people were yet in the sea and the water was split on either side of them, it was closing, the walls were closing in on the Egyptians who were behind them. It was, if you would picture the Red Sea at that time, the front part would be open for the Jewish people, but the back part was already closing in on the Mitzrim. I once suggested, as a digression, there's two psukim which are very similar to each other. We know them quite well, describing the events of Kriyas Yamsuf. For it says, the Jewish people go through, V'hamayim lahem choma miminam umismolam. The water was a wall to their right and to their left. And many Mefarshim ask, what's the repetition? It is noted that the word choma is not spelled the same way in those two times. The first time, which is in Perek Yudalet Pasuk Kaf Beis, it says, V'amayim lehem choma, and choma is written with a vav, male with a vav. The second, seven psukim later in Pasuk Kaf Tes, it says, V'amayim lehem choma, without a vav. And there's much discussion about that, exactly what that means. I wonder whether one could say that the resolution, I don't think the Ibn Ezra would say this, but one could say, based on the Ibn Ezra, to use his understanding, that this is what's behind the different spellings. Because what is described in between these two psukim is the Egyptians entering the Yamsuf. Well, what is the difference in connotation between a word that's written mole, for example here, choma with a vav, or choser, without a vav? When something is written mole, it describes something that is fully the case. But if it's written choser, with something missing, it's because there's something missing. It is incomplete. And that's exactly the case with the walls. Because when the Jewish people first go through, and they're the only ones in the sea, the entire sea splits open. So the choma is choma mole. It's fully split. But the second time round, the sea is walls on either side of them, but not completely, because behind them, it's already come in again. And therefore it's choma without a vav, because the walls themselves were choser. At any rate, if we come back to the words ze keli v'anvehu, as we saw, what these words denote, according to the Abba Shaul and the Gemara, Shabbos Kuf Lamed Gimel, Hevi Domelo, to emulate Hashem. And our question was, why is that mentioned here? But in light of this discussion, and the discussion, by the way, is based on a sefer called Uri V'Yishi, Rav Uri Jungreis is his name, a wonderful Talmud Chacham, lives in Yerushalayim. Once we understand that all of Kriyas Yamsuf was meant as a lesson for the Jewish people, it was meant as an example for the Jewish people. Hashem is saying, I've given form to matter, and so should you. So when we celebrate that with Az Yashir, one of the first things we says is, we will try. Ze keli va'anvehu, anivahu. I will try and emulate HaKadosh Baruch Hu to the best that I can, as he wanted me to do, and as he demonstrated for me through Kriyas Yamsuf. We're not going to be able to split the Yamsuf, but each one in their own way can impose a form on a formless world around them. And indeed, if we move for a moment to the level of remes, the word Adam, the name Adam for a person, has two meanings. One of the meanings, you could say, is actually quite demeaning, because it relates the word Adam to Adama. Adama is earth, dirt, and that's man. Adam, he's Adama. That's essentially what he is. But that is not the only understanding of the word or association of the word Adam. There is a much more elevated association. Rav Hirsch speaks about it, as do others. And that is the word Adam comes from the word Edame. Edame means I will emulate, Dome. Edame la Elyon. The full meaning of the word Adam itself was made apparent to the Jewish people as they went through the Yamsuf, because Hashem is saying, this is me and you be Edame. That's what it means to be an Adam. To be an Adam doesn't just mean to be like water or like earth with no form. It means to be Edame. To strive towards emulating Hashem. Within the experience of Kriyas Yamsuf, we found the meaning. We found man. Where is the remez? Says the Uri V'Yishi. How does the pasuk describe the splitting of the Red Sea? With the words Vayibaku Hamayim. Vayibaku Hamayim. The water split. What happens when water splits? Well, what is water? Mayim. Mayim, mem yud mem, has a numerical value of 90. Two mems, 40 each, and then yud. If you split mayim, if you split the 90, so you get 45. And that's Adam. That's the gematria of Adam. Aleph, Dalet, Mem. So in other words, by Yibakov HaMayim, through splitting the water, Adam emerged in terms of what his capabilities are and what his mission is, as is expressed uniquely and first and foremost by the Jewish people. So Achar HaDvarim HaEileh, and I think it's maybe a less standard way of looking at Kriyas Yamsuf. With so much else going on, it's easy not to perhaps engage in this element of the experience, but then we miss out, because we can now understand why the Medrash says that the Jewish people are called Ivrim because of our Yam. They went through the Yam. And as we noted, if your name comes from the fact that you went through the sea, it's got to be that says something about you, not just something that you experienced, but something that you are. Because through going through the Yam, through being of our Yam, the Ivrim discovered who they are and what they're capable of and what's demanded of them. And this, therefore, was a crucial station, shall we say. It was a station of revelation. That's really an element of Kriyas Yamsuf that also can go missed. The famous statement, Zekeli va'anvehu. Zekeli, the Shivcha sees at the Yamsuf what even the Nevi'im didn't see. Rashi quotes it, Zekeli va'anvehu. That tells us, and whatever the substance or whatever the content of that revelation, but the very fact that going through the Yamsuf was a time of revelation, we could completely miss that. We just say, revelation will come at Sinai. You just have to get there. And if the shortest way is through the Yamsuf, then let it split on your way to revelation. But Shira Sayam says, no, Kriyas Yamsuf wasn't just something that was on the way to revelation. It was a station where revelation itself happened. Zekeli va'anvehu, we weren't just saved, we were also educated. And we were also given to understand something very core about what it means to be an Ivri, and that is to bestow Tzura on a world of Chomer, as would then be elaborated upon when we got to Sinai to hear the Torah with all of its details. So this, I believe, not only gives us new insight into Kriyas Yamsuf, which is important for the Parsha, but it's important because Az Yashir is something that's referenced on a daily basis. And perhaps now we can understand why. It's not just, quote unquote, to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim, but also to remind ourselves of what we learned about ourselves as we left Mitzrayim, because that, like Yetzias Mitzrayim itself, is of relevance to us on a daily basis. So that is a very wonderful discussion of the Ori V'Yishi on Kriyas Yamsuf, and we'll leave it over here for this evening. All the best.